exactly. We're going to start without her for exactly that reason. Good morning. So let me start by welcoming you all back from coffee. My name is Mitchell Warren. I direct AVAC, an advocacy organization focused on HIV prevention, based in New York. I want to assure you that this is two things about this panel. It will be very interactive, and it will not just be three white guys. We're going to change the diversity very quickly after these first two presentations. Oh, is it okay? Oh. So the structure for the panel is going to be two relatively brief presentations, followed by a number of additional panelists joining us. We'll ask a few questions, but I'm really hoping we can engage with the audience at large in this session, because I know there were already several questions from the morning from people standing at the microphone. I want to start with two quick things. One, the session is, as you see in the program, titled PrEP Implementation. We had terrific presentations this morning about the research, and I think it's very important, following on that very last point in the morning session, if we waited to answer all questions about any product, we wouldn't register anything, and we wouldn't do anything in public health. In public health, the modus operandi is to do the best that we can with the information that we have. But this session is very much on the implementation side of PrEP, and so I hope that as you formulate your questions for the panelists, it will be not about what we do and don't know from clinical trials, but really about what comes next. And I was very struck, just to kind of frame it all, a couple of weeks ago, Jim Kim was at the Gates Foundation. So that's kind of a big deal when the head of the World Bank goes to the First National Bank of Gates. And he did something that was very interesting. He's been fairly controversial at the Gates Foundation, as I understand it, in past years, where he's often said that there's too little attention to the fruits of research, too much focus on developing new tools. And he said, as a TB doc himself, he's the first one that says we need new tools. But he talked a couple of weeks ago. He said, the problem is that we don't really invest as much time and energy into thinking about how to deliver the tools. We're creating a stockpile of tools that may never get to those most at need. And he said, all I'm saying is that this is not just that this delivery is just as complicated, I would add it may even be more complicated, than developing them at the outset. We need to bring the same kind of rigorous approach and scientific thinking to delivering the tools that we bring to creating them. So if we could just kind of channel Jim Kim and his delivery mentality as we transition from this morning about proving that PrEP works if you use it into how do we ensure that we can get public health impact out of the science. So we're going to start then with two hopefully relatively brief presentations. The first is Jim Rooney, who many of you met yesterday. And anyone working in PrEP knows Jim. Without Jim, who's at Gilead Sciences, there frankly wouldn't be PrEP research with tenofovir alone or in combination with emtricitabine. He's been a champion within the company and a partner to everyone involved in the research. So Jim.
Mitchell, thank you very much. You're very kind. And actually, queuing up on your comment, I'll add that with respect to implementation, to some extent, things have been facilitated greatly with respect to the use of Truvada for PrEP, in that it's a measurable entity, so that adherence to PrEP with Truvada can be determined relatively quickly by measuring blood levels by any of a variety of different techniques. So going forward, as we ask questions of specific patient populations with regard to adherence, et cetera, one can design a study relatively quickly or even a lead-in to a trial relatively quickly to determine whether that particular patient population is likely to view that intervention as being acceptable. So I envision that that will become an increasingly common part of many studies that are going forward looking at Truvada for PrEP. So I'd like to walk you a little bit through some of the Gilead-specific or Truvada-specific activities related to PrEP. And since the approval a year or so ago, and give you a little bit of an update in terms of the activities that we have ongoing and where we see things from the Gilead perspective. So, as you know, about a year ago, Truvada was approved for pre-exposure prophylaxis in the U.S. And the indication, as noted in the label, is that Truvada is indicated in combination with safer sex practices for pre-exposure prophylaxis to reduce the risk of sexually acquired HIV infection in adults at high risk. And the indication was based on clinical trials in MSM at high risk for HIV infection and in heterosexual discordant couples, combined with some additional studies that provided supportive information. Of course, since then, there's also been data presented in the IDU patient population showing that Viriad alone had a significant benefit as well. Although that's not reflected currently in the indication, it is reflected in some guidelines that are being developed. So also in the label are factors to identify individuals at high risk. So individuals that have partners known to be HIV infected or that engage in individuals that engage in sexual activity within a high prevalence area or social network and one or more of the following, and it lists a variety of high risk activities: inconsistent or no condom use, diagnosis of sexually transmitted infections, exchange of sex for commodities, use of illicit drugs, incarceration, or partners of unknown HIV status. And in addition, also in the label, it very clearly states that Truvada is a part of a comprehensive prevention strategy. It's not a strategy alone by itself, and that individuals are supposed to be counseled to strictly adhere to a daily dosing schedule. That's because of the close relationship between adherence and efficacy that you've heard about earlier this morning. Very important, of course, to confirm a negative HIV test prior to implementing PrEP, because Truvada itself is not an effective regimen for the treatment of HIV infection. And in terms of monitoring individuals who are on PrEP, they should be seen at least every 3 months and tested. There's also what's called the Risk Evaluation and Mitigation Strategy, or REMS, which is a strategy implemented in the U.S. for monitoring of a variety of pharmacologic interventions, and it's intended to address issues related to safety. The REMS for Truvada is largely educational. It doesn't involve drug distribution or other things that some REMS do, but it emphasizes three key factors: the importance of adherence, the importance of regular monitoring of HIV serostatus, and that Truvada for PrEP must be part of a comprehensive prevention strategy. There's a variety of materials available through the REMS. These are available online, and to any of you that would like to reach them at the TruvadaPrepREMS.com. It includes a healthcare provider letter, various safety information, an agreement form, a checklist for prescribers, and the full prescribing information. And these can be downloaded from the site. In addition, there's a variety of non-REMS measures that are available, made available by Gilead. They include free HIV and HBV testing for qualified individuals, free condoms, subsidized HIV viral resistance testing to individuals who seroconvert, support for community education and demonstration projects, and also a medication assistance program for those individuals who do not have the financial resources to be able to afford PrEP. So how will PrEP be made available in clinical practice? The drugs will be the same for HIV prevention as they are for treatment, so it'll be Truvada. It is Truvada in the U.S. and will be elsewhere. And in the developing world, the generic versions could be used as well. The guidance to guide use could be either in the label through regulatory process or normative through review and recommendations, guidelines that might be made on a regional or on a country-specific basis. There are guidelines that have been generated in a variety of different jurisdictions. Regulatory filings, in addition to the U.S., we're planning now to do regulatory filings in the developing world, and South Africa will actually be the first country in which we'll be making an application sometime later on this year. Access to medication remains to be determined at the local level, but the Gilead Access Program that we talked about yesterday will be one means to access it in the developing world. We did already talk about the Access Program yesterday. And obviously, Gilead continues to provide support for ongoing research, and Ken went through a lot of this information earlier today, but there's a variety of both ongoing Phase 3 studies, as well as looking at Phase 3 extensions and rollovers, various demonstration projects looking at the practical issues related to rolling out Truvada PrEP. In addition, Phase 1 and 2 studies looking at different types of interventions, alternative dosing schedules, alternative regimens, and alternative patient populations. The use of PrEP for safe conception in HIV-discordant couples, so what's known as, nicknamed as PrEPception, as well as the use of Viriad or emtricitabine or various other Viriad tenofovir prodrugs in other forms when administered as a microbicide, either vaginal, rectal, new formulations in patient populations being studied, as well as new prodrugs such as GS7340 or TAF that's now being explored in different formulations in different animal models. This is a list of the variety of some of the phase 3B4 and demonstration projects that are ongoing, a total of 25 studies, almost 24,000 subjects that could potentially be enrolled in these trials. This is a list, I'm not going to go through them in detail, but a list of the studies that are looking at men who have sex with men. The largest studies, of course, are the phase 3 studies or the rollovers. That's led to a variety of demonstration projects, which generally involve a much smaller number of subjects, as we were talking about earlier, but look at specific issues in specific patient populations and geographies about how best to deliver PrEP. And again, for heterosexual women and men, there probably needs to be more studies in women and in the heterosexual patient populations about appropriate use of PrEP, particularly in the developed world. And so that's an area that we're encouraging further research. There's a variety of challenges to implementation in general. I think they were covered in some of the talks earlier today, but specifically with respect to the U.S., initial uptake of PrEP was initially slow, but as has been discussed earlier, this is really a new strategy that's being unfolded, so it's going to take some time. In the U.S., we need to remind ourselves that there's very limited provider experience. There were a small number of patients enrolled in clinical trials. There are only 3 U.S. sites in the trials that we use for registration. Less than 1,000 out of the 10,000 subjects that are involved in the registration package were actually in the U.S. So there was very little provider experience in terms of delivering PrEP. And the system is not really, in the U.S., a healthcare delivery system, not optimally set up for delivering PrEP. It sort of falls between the folks who deliver treatment that primarily take care of HIV-positive patients and those who do prevention, who oftentimes provide counseling but not necessarily prescribe medications. So there are many practical questions about delivering this. Reimbursement for drug and services provided for PrEP are not clear. There's a low level of awareness among subjects and providers, as Ken illustrated this morning in some of the surveys that have been carried out. The eligible subject's not clearly defined. But the good news is this can all be addressed with additional research. Ken also briefly mentioned a study that was presented at ICAC about 2 weeks ago. Gilead's required by in our post-marketing requirements to periodically assess within the U.S. how PrEP is being used. So we conduct a study periodically, twice a year, that looks at it's a prospective 3-year observational trial that looks at patient de-identified data and tries to determine how Truvada might be used. And there's an algorithm for sorting out the various potential uses, excluding HIV treatment, post-exposure prophylaxis, and off-label use for hepatitis B. And based upon that algorithm, it was found in the first analysis that's been carried out that there are roughly 1,774 individuals, roughly 1,800 individuals had received Truvada for PrEP between 2011 and March 2013. The median age was 37 years. Interestingly, almost 50% were women, and it was given by roughly 1,700 unique prescribers. And there were some surprising findings here. Only 37% of the providers for PrEP actually had prescribed Truvada for HIV treatment. So it was clearly a very different prescribing a group. The most common geographic area where it was distributed was in the Southeast, and it was women were represented to a much larger degree than we initially suspected. In terms of those types of doctors or the types of healthcare providers that were prescribing PrEP, actually, if you combine nurse practitioners and physician assistants, they were actually the largest group, followed by family practice and internal medicine. And infectious disease docs and other specialists were surprisingly quite low on the list, despite the fact, I think, that the surveys have showed that they would be willing to prescribe it. And then, some of the compared to HIV-positive subjects, they were 1.4 times more likely to be from the South, 1.8 times more likely to be female, 1.4 times more likely to be younger than 25 years of age, and 3.8 times more likely to be treated by non-ID physicians. So in conclusion, Truvada has been approved for pre-exposure prophylaxis indication in the U.S. A REMS program is in place to ensure a safe and appropriate use of PrEP. Ongoing demonstration projects will yield very important information on the use of Truvada for PrEP when given in an open-label fashion. Gilead's committed to supporting a comprehensive prevention program via education, but is not actively promoting the indication. We haven't talked about this in great detail, but it's a subject of some discussion. I'd be happy to talk about it afterwards if anyone wants to talk about why we're doing that or during the panel discussion. And Truvada for PrEP's now being implemented in the U.S. Initial uptake's been slow, but it is improving over time. It's really similar to a product launch, but it's really a new strategy launch. So it will take, I think, 5 to 10 years for us to realize the potential of the strategy in the U.S. And obviously the phase 3B4 studies that are ongoing to evaluate its use as well as in new formulations and combinations will be important as well. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jim. As Jared gets his slides ready, I'll just make one quick comment, and that is, as an advocacy organization, we take no money from industry, including from Gilead, but we did support very much the approval of FDA, and I have to say that seeing the data presented like that, Jim, is what we'd said at the FDA hearing. We need to be able to track this, and the requirement on the company to report to FDA and to all of us that uptake, I think, is a great reason why FDA approval matters. So thanks. Jared Baton from the University of Washington. In the context of this presentation, as the co-chair along with Connie Kellum of the Partners PrEP study, one of the pivotal trials that Jim referred to that led to licensure that took place in Kenya and Uganda. In addition, Jared is leading and working with a number of colleagues on what comes next after Partners PrEP. So over to you, Jared. Yeah.
Good morning, everybody. This talk is hopefully a bridge to an active panel discussion. I'm giving the title of the session is Implementation Perspectives, and I will give one perspective with mostly a lot of questions that hopefully my fellow panelists will actually answer in the next hour. And those are my disclosures. So this is where I feel like we are as a starting point. So, you know, the trials were complicated. There is, someone said, ad nauseum commentary on PrEP yesterday and the FDA. And this is an actual slide from an airport in the United States where you go through that TSA place and you don't have your shoes on anymore and you lost all of your shampoo. This is an actual slide. This is where we are in terms of implementation, I think. So here are my perspectives on what we're thinking about right now in terms of PrEP implementation. The questions, the interface with ART for prevention, which I think is a really important discussion for much of the work that I do, but also for much of the, you know, for this meeting in general, and then talking a little bit about risks. So first, the questions. I want to emphasize first and foremost, as someone who did the clinical, who did one of the clinical trials of PrEP and who now tries to work on implementation with many, many, many other people, that the transition from trials to delivery opens up, I think, entirely a new set of questions with new expectations, reset expectations, and different approaches to quantify and measure success. And as we go through the questions in the panel today, I think we should keep that in mind. I'm going to lay out a series of questions that I think are important. These are not comprehensive, but this gives sort of a direction of many of the things that those of us who are doing implementation are thinking about. How to deliver PrEP, how to deliver PrEP, where to deliver PrEP, and how to do that at scale. Demonstration projects, to some extent, are exploring some possible models of delivery in STD clinics, in LGBT centers, in HIV testing and care centers, and in various populations, some of which were covered within the clinical trials, some of which, like female sex workers, are new. But the totality of how PrEP could be delivered is not explored, and even some of the information that Jim just provided suggests that there is delivery of PrEP going on outside demonstration projects in ways that weren't explored in the clinical trials. And I really want to emphasize, I'm primary care trained and as also infectious disease trained, but what is the capacity to add PrEP to primary care services, but also specialty services, but primary care services as a primary prevention intervention? We need to think about uptake, and uptake in a very different way than we thought about uptake in clinical trials. Who and how to prioritize people for PrEP, and do those who most benefit from one of it, benefit, might they want it? What are the tools to help providers who may not do this all the time identify those who are most appropriate for PrEP, how to ask about risk and how to offer PrEP, and how to have objective tools that might help in a waiting room or on a computer or on a tablet or something else identify those who are most willing for PrEP? We have developed a risk score for HIV serotype-scoring couples for Africa that might help countries decide where to prioritize their PrEP money if they're so willing to put money into PrEP. Our initial data suggests that demand is there when there's information for PrEP, and I think we heard a lot about this from Ken today and then from Jim and now here, that much of the gap in PrEP implementation is lack of information and availability. But in San Francisco in the demonstration project, the anecdote is that there's more than 50 people on their waiting list at all times throughout the project, and what we're seeing in Kenya and Uganda in our demonstration project is initial uptake of PrEP of greater than 90%. So people are interested in taking it when there's availability and when there's information. The great challenge, of course, is that there's a big gap. We need to think, of course, about adherence to PrEP, but we need to think what is the expectation for adherence and how do we maximize that. I would argue that in contrast to the clinical trials, which expected 100% sustained adherence in everybody who was enrolled, perhaps, in retrospect, which was a great challenge, implementation instead will focus on those who have continued PrEP interest and those who will continue to return for refills. Not everyone started on PrEP will be expected 5 years from now to be still taking it and still taking with high adherence, but those who are being prescribed, because there will be cost associated with that, should be taking it with high adherence. I think that those who don't want PrEP in many cases won't come back. They won't achieve the benefits of PrEP, but they'll also have no programmatic costs. And I think we need to think about PrEP takers in the same way we think about takers of other preventative strategies or other treatment strategies for diabetes and hypertension and other things. And those who use PrEP will achieve the prevention benefits like with other prevention strategies. Those will be the takers and the non-takers. Sorry, those are reversed. And I want to make the analogy to other things we use for prevention, floss and contraception and condoms, where we don't expect every single person who has teeth. We know that every single person who has teeth should floss, but not all of us do. And we know that every single woman is at risk for pregnancy and reproductive age, but not all do. But when there is uptake, then we want adherence to be high. And in many settings where we work, 20 or 30% uptake of effective contraception is a programmatic success. We want to think about risks. Sexual behavior and STIs and antiretroviral resistance, and I would emphasize that we need data here because so much of this has been driven by hypotheses but not by data. We have some data. In Partners PrEP, when we stopped our placebo arm in July of 2011, we had everybody receiving active PrEP thereafter. And what we see, these are data presented at ISSTDR in Vienna this summer, average frequency of unprotected sex, the average frequency of STIs, and the frequency of pregnancy changed, not at all, from when people were in a placebo-controlled phase when they didn't know something was effective to when they were all being told that you're receiving active PrEP and it works for prevention. So more empiric data will be helpful here. And we need to think about impact. In terms of programmatic success, of course, HIV incidence and costs. We need to think about how programmatic success will be defined for PrEP, with the recognition that PrEP is not for everyone, not for everyone at high risk, and certainly not forever. We had mentioned the PrEP cascade this morning, and what can be better defined in the PrEP cascade among who is tested, who has access to ongoing testing, linkage to prevention services, initiation and sustained use of PrEP and other prevention options, and importantly, support for PrEP discontinuation when people are no longer at risk. In this way, PrEP is completely different than antiretroviral therapy, that PrEP is time-limited, much like contraception, during periods of high risk and recognition of risk. So these are the questions, re-summarized here, that I think about for PrEP. And there are many, many more, but this is sort of a general framework to think about it. How does this interface with ART for prevention? I work as much on ART for prevention as I do on PrEP implementation, and one of the things that I've noticed is that the series of questions is actually very similar when we think about ART for prevention. How to deliver to scale, who will take it, what will adherence be like, what will the risks be, and what will the impact be? And I think it's a very important thing to think about as we all work on these things together, that these are part of a very similar set of strategies. There is debate about how to balance antiretroviral therapy and PrEP prevention. These are recent news articles from Uganda, where there has been some question about how to integrate PrEP into a prevention strategy for the country and advocacy push on integrating new prevention strategies. And I think this is important debate that should continue. When we think about, in our group, when we think about PrEP and ART for delivery, we think about synergies. We work a lot with HIV serodiscordant couples in East Africa. We know a lot of HIV-positive partners and serodiscordant couples, in spite of very intensive counseling and very good access to therapy, will choose to delay or will not start antiretroviral therapy immediately because they're not eligible under country guidelines. And for them, staged use of PrEP as a bridge to antiretroviral therapy can be effective, certainly, and potentially cost-effective with mathematical modeling that's cited here. At the population level, risk-targeted PrEP in lots of models can be additive to antiretroviral therapy. And demonstration projects, in my opinion, delivering PrEP and maximal push for antiretroviral therapy should be prioritized for priority populations. And here are some examples. Our own partner's demonstration project was mentioned this morning, and I want to talk about this just in a little bit. The goal is to understand prevention preferences, uptake of ART and PrEP, adherence and risk behavior in a prospective observational study of 1,000 serodiscordant couples in Kenya and Uganda, none of whom participated in the partner's PrEP study, so brand new couples, delivered at HIV care centers with PrEP being offered as a bridge to ART. And this is the graphic that Ken presented earlier today, where couples are recruited, offered antiretroviral therapy according to country guidelines, and in those who decline or delay antiretroviral therapy or who are just starting, we offer pre-exposure prophylaxis to a negative partner as a bridge to timing of initiation of antiretroviral therapy, and then discontinue PrEP once the dyad, is stably on antiretroviral therapy. And this may be one way to think about how to use PrEP in a time-limited fashion to have its greatest impact. I also think we have to change how we talk about PrEP, both PrEP and ART. This poster from the poster on the left from the United States about why not to get HIV because the drugs are horrible, and then this paper that we did that's been cited a few times at this meeting about impressions of antiretroviral treatment. We have done a very good job as providers about saying you don't need ART until you are a sick person, which is now interpreted as if we give you ART, you are a sick person. And we cannot continue to have that conversation with people. A change in messages about antiretroviral therapy being health-preserving and not reflecting late-stage sickness is really needed if antiretroviral therapy will be rolled out to healthier people. PrEP, similarly, can be discussed as health-preserving and, importantly, not lifelong, with seasons of PrEP or times of PrEP potentially avoiding 40-plus years of antiretroviral therapy. And we need messages that have fewer academic caveats and better respond to patient needs. We also have to think about the risks. This is a quote from nearly 10 years ago now about how antiretroviral therapy would be a failure in the places where I've worked, and predetermining failure with ART has not been helpful. I would also say, when we look ahead, that new options for PrEP might be on the horizon, or they might not be, and holding out for something that may or may not come is very challenging when we have tools, as Jim Kim has already said, that might be here. Because the risk is persistent or increasing incidence, even in the context of high ART access, like we've seen here in the UK or in my country, the United States, with cascades of lost opportunities in treatment and prevention, and the result being an ever-increasing treatment need without turning off the tap of new infections. So my summary is there are new and different questions for PrEP, great parallels, and I think great synergies with treatment for prevention, and risks in doing, yes, but risks in not doing enough just as much. So change does not happen instantly. This is a poster from the University of Washington Hospital where we do a lot of reminding for doctors to wash their hands. When I showed this to Mitchell yesterday, he said, "What do you mean doctors at the University of Washington don't wash their hands?" But I think all of us who work in care realize that there's a lot of efforts to remind doctors to wash their hands every time you go in and out of rooms, something that we've known for 150 years. So diffusion of innovation is a process, and we will get there with science and advocacy and public health focus. Thank you very much. I work with many great people.
Jared, thank you so much. My doctor, I think, just must be rubbing his hands together. Let me have the panel then join us up here in the order that I hope they'll kind of stand so I can make sure that you know who they are. Daryl Wheeler from Loyola University in Chicago. Lute Van Damme from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in Seattle. Sheena McCormick from the Medical Research Council here in London. Helen Rees from the WITS Reproductive Health and Research Institute in Johannesburg, South Africa. And Suwat Charyalartsakh from the University of Chiang Mai in Thailand, each with incredible experiences, work that they are doing, continue to do around PrEP, around treatment, around that interface that Jared just described. I'm happy to ask a few questions, but we really want to do something a little bit differently than the other sessions where I'm not going to have each of them say a few words so that we can get straight into questions and hopefully open up the mics within just a couple of minutes. I do want to start, and I think that both Jim and Jared described an enormous amount of activity going on. And I want to start maybe, we talk a lot about Africa, so maybe starting with Helen. Sitting in South Africa, one of the things that Jared just described was, understanding for whom this intervention might be and who might want it. And we talk a lot about men who have sex with men. We talk a lot about serodiscordant couples, but you look at the epidemiology around your unit in Johannesburg, and it's young women. And I'm wondering if you can just briefly describe what are some of the practical challenges and issues and how you're going to planning to overcome them with prep and demonstration projects.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the first thing to say is that, as you've mentioned, despite what UNAIDS is announcing at the moment in New York, that our epidemic continues to really significantly affect young women. I mean, many of you know that in all of these prevention studies, we're still seeing incidents up to sort of 8-9% in some communities, but very commonly 4%, 5%, very, very common. And if we look at the antenatal survey, that continues. We also know that things like looking at the demographic and health surveys and the various other surveys, that condom use is apparently decreasing. So I think the first thing that we have to note is that our prevention package is not working. Mm-hmm. And it's not working for young women. The second thing I think is very important, nobody's really mentioned this, is that if we've done studies in countries in sub-Saharan Africa which have demonstrated this effect, I think there's a real ethical, everyone's talking about the ethics of treatment versus prevention, there's a real ethical challenge to us to say, and now we're not going to try and roll this out? We've done the study, we've demonstrated effect, we've had populations who've been willing to participate, and now we're saying, oh, but now hang on a minute, let's slow up. So I think that we will have to think about this. But one of the things we will also have to consider as we think about what the package of care is not only what we've learned about PrEP in studies. I think a third lesson we've learned is that we're very narrow in what we learn from studies. We say PrEP works. We don't say PrEP works, but a lot of young women are dogged in their lives by gender-based violence. So if you have a package, let's look what else we've learned. And let's put into that package other aspects of things that we've learned, not just the standard, you know, the condom and the male and the female condom, but let's look at those other things. Social support works, social networks work. So I think that for all of those reasons, we should be looking at this. The last point I'd make, though, is that if you look at the way we looked at introducing treatment and the way we introduced PMTCT, we didn't just say, you know, now we found the drug solution, so let's just toss it in. We did lots of pilots. We scaled up. We learned lessons. We modified. We stopped. We started. We did some things well, some things less well. And I think that that's what we will have to do. I don't think that we're at a point where we could throw this en masse into the system. The system wouldn't cope. But we should look at feasible pilots that take all the lessons, and we should target young women in that.
No, that's great. Let me similarly, Daryl, let me just turn to you. I mean, you're working in a country where PrEP is approved, unlike any place else in the world, although I was delighted that Jim said that there'll be an application in South Africa. And you work with particularly young black gay men. You know, they were not well represented within the IPREC study. How do you bridge to that community, and what are you hearing from the community?
Certainly. Thank you for the question. Yes, working with African-American and black men in the United States, I mean, the issues are similar to many that have been discussed, but interestingly different. In the United States, with black men, we have to deal with the social networks, the structural issues, absolutely, and understanding from a unique cultural lens what are the cascade of life circumstances that the men themselves are grappling with. I was struck when we talk about issues of health that we don't have a solid understanding of what health means in the perspective of young black men in the United States, particularly when I look at issues of, you talk about interpartner violence, but community violence and racism and the class issues that exist for men in the United States. High rates of incarceration, low rates of poor education, high unemployment are social factors that impact African-American men in the United States at a disparate rate. And we really have to understand those numbers as we start to talk to men about what are the things that you calculate into when you think about your well-being and whether or not you're going to take or not take a pharmacological agent over any period of time. When we talk about a prevention package, for some men, sexual behavior is that rite to passage, and having children in the next generation becomes a necessity of survival within a community, and it also becomes the kind of thing that people use to demarcate their manhood, and we're talking about taking that away in some instances by the use of condoms. And then when we talk about things of a same-gendered related nature, men who have sex with men, not all men who have sex with men are only having sex with men. And understanding the fluidity of the sexual experience and how people negotiate that in their lived experiences. It's not just about using violence, but it's about understanding how men who engage in sex when they're in isolated situations, incarcerated sometimes, or they engage, we're understanding in terms of gang membership and violence and introduction and initiation of that. I know in our studies we find at least one-third of our men are always reporting that they have been physically abused, sexually abused at a very early age. And so, again, understanding what that means in the lives of the men. And then finally, recognizing that in the United States, providers have not been well oriented to serving the needs of black men. And so for a captive audience, it becomes the providers who actually, and I think Reve was saying this earlier, become the conduits to change. And understanding how we as providers can train the next generation of providers to actively listen and engage with black men to understand what their factors are that impact their risk and their ability to potentially use Truvada or any of the prevention packages.
That's great. This issue of providers is just amazing to me. We've been saying it for years, as long as we've been studying PrEP, and yet I still hear every presentation we need to do more with providers. So perhaps on that, I'm thinking about providers and condoms, a great combination. Let me turn to you, Sheena. Working here in the UK, where PrEP has not been approved, not been rolled out to any significant degree. But to get a sense about some of these issues as you think about the way forward, and particularly we hear a lot about condomless sex, does PrEP, you know, how does PrEP change that dynamic? And I'm wondering, as both a researcher and a provider, if you have some thoughts on that.
So perhaps it's important to say, first of all, that the provider issue for us is much easier in the UK. Because the providers of antiretroviral treatment are the providers of prevention through the sexual health clinic network. So I think we do have practical advantages in that regard, at least familiarity with the drugs, and we're already seeing the populations. But that said, and we have excellent reporting into our national surveillance, so we have a reasonable good handle on the epidemic, and over 80% of the tests in gay and other men who have sex with men are done in these clinics, and over 80% of the HIV is managed in these clinics. So we have these advantages already. But what I wanted to say, so the risk compensation, the condom question, Mitchell, when we had the consultation after IPREX about what should we do in the UK, the main issue for a range of different stakeholders was what's going to happen to condom use and what's going to happen to the numbers of partners with whom condomless sex takes place, because we know those are markers for increased risk of HIV and other STIs. So that's why we opted to do the design in the clinical research study that we're doing. It's not because we have any concerns about the biological efficacy of Truvada, but we want to know what the effect is in the real world when people who want PrEP are coming forward to take it, and what impact that's going to have on these other behaviours and STIs. So I think what we've learned in the study, we've enrolled over 260 people now in the PrEP study, half of them are on PrEP and half of them are not, is a number of things. I mean, certainly it looks really as if, and this is speaking to what both Darren and Helen have raised, that really there are an awful lot of other factors that influence behaviour, and PrEP is only playing quite a small role in those. So if people move into relationships, that's immediately going to alter the risk behaviour pattern. But there are, you know, we have two HIV tests in the clinic that we use, one of which is incredibly reliable, and that's the detection of virus in people who are positive and on treatment. And the other one is extremely unreliable, and that's the test, the antigen antibody test for HIV negative status. So everyone has picked up that the person walking out of the clinic today with an HIV negative result is still carrying the risk of possible seroconversion. And we know from the excellent data we have in the UK that probably the highest proportion of people who are infectious in the community belong to this group who think they're negative because their last test was negative. And I put it to everybody that we already know that if you have someone in the clinic who's had more than one partner in the last 6 weeks, then they're potentially at risk of having acquired HIV if they've not used a condom. So, Jim, your recommendation of this immediate, you know, the testing, and don't test again for a month before you start Truvada, it's just not practical. And if we're not going to acknowledge the fact that the numbers of partners are greater than one without condoms in the last 6 weeks, and see the role of PrEP as a tool of engagement for this population, not only reducing their risk, but their risk of passing HIV on to other individuals, then we're really missing a key opportunity here.
Great.
So it's a tool of engagement for the HIV-negative end of the cascade.
Thank you so much, Sheena. I am not ignoring Luton Suwat, but what I'm going to do really quickly, because I do want to make sure we get questions from the floor, is quickly go to the microphones, and I'm going to ask people to make their questions incredibly brief. So seconds, not minutes. So if you have a question, jump to the microphone now. I'm going to write them down, and then we'll go back to both Suwat, Luton, and the rest of the panel. The young man in the back.
What's your...
Like I said.
What's your tattoo from Imperial College? What I'm going to say, I'm not going to say it... as Imperial College employee, but as myself. First, a quick note on the title of the panel. It's perspective from the field, and I think we should qualify that. That's the medical field. Now, quick comment. I think Lord Fowler was bemused at the approach of the US regarding IDU and prevention of HIV, and I'm bemused by the approach to PrEP in the UK, a country I've been living in for 17 years. The IPREX study started the revolution 3 years ago, maybe not in what we are doing, but at least in what we are thinking. And it took 3 years for the organization in charge of delivering prevention in this country to actually acknowledge that PrEP exists. Even last Sunday, one of the major organizations was still in denial about PrEP and recommending various sizes and shapes and colors of condom as HIV prevention. So my question is, will PrEP ever be available in this country? When will it be available? Because at the pace we are going, I don't see that happening, and who will be held responsible and accountable for the infection that we could actually prevent now? Thank you.
Fabulous. Great. Let me go to the middle and we'll work our way. Go ahead.
John Mills, Australia. I'd like to go back to the question of whether what the risk is for giving Truvada or tenofovir-based PrEP in patients who are in the very early stages of HIV infection. The genetic barrier with tenofovir is reasonably good. It would be very interesting, I think, to do some studies in macaques to see if macaques who are in the pre-antigen-positive stage of HIV infection, and what happens if you give those animals tenofovir. And I'd reckon, just as a guess, I'll take a bet on it if you'd like, that you'd have a pretty good therapeutic efficacy, at least for the next month or two.
Do people think about that to the left?
Yeah, Gus, yeah. To Jim Rooney, really. I already wrote up, actually, your little study of PrEP prescribing from ICAC, but it's very difficult to put it in context because you have a estimated numbers of the number of people who could be in demonstration projects and pilot studies, and I know that you've actually, there's likely to be less than that because not all studies will fully come to fruition. You have a survey of prescribing, but I don't actually have a sort of a means of comparing those two and to say, is it really the case, for instance, that PrEP is being prescribed to more young women than you might think, or is it that most of the gay men are in the demonstration studies? So a comment on that. And I just wanted to answer Roger's comment about PrEP. The reason that PrEP has not been adopted so far in the UK is because of the money. Having been in a meeting where an NHS commissioner sort of panicked because we were suggesting that people might like to follow the Beaver guidelines and ask for treatment as prevention with CD4s over 350, I know the amount of resistance in the NHS to spending money on any new ARVs, and they don't even know who's going to pay for it yet in terms of the new structure, so they are requiring a very high level of evidence before they are going to move.
Great, a very different resistance test. let me stay here, and then we're going to work just to the people standing, and then we're going to go to the panel. Go ahead, Anna.
Hi, Anna Forbes from the United States. We know very well from the history of the female condom what happens when we introduce a new prevention tool without appropriate provider buy-in and without appropriate provider involvement in promoting the new tool to their patients. I'm very concerned that we're going to see the same thing with PrEP, particularly if there's not broad provider education, because it is a new thing. We noticed in Mr. Rooney's presentation that only 8% of nurse practitioners, I believe, and or 8% of the prescribers were nurse practitioners, and 9% were physician's assistants. Those are the providers that are most typically able to reach women in particular. So I was wondering about the panel's comments about what it would take to really do adequate provider education around PrEP, including providers that are not internal medicine docs, and when and how we think that's going to happen.
Great. Let me do these four really quickly.
I have two questions for Jim Rooney. Thank you very much. My name is Heiko Jessen, Berlin, Germany. Why is, as you said, Gilead not promoting the indication for PrEP if we all assume that it might help reducing the incidence of HIV? Second questions. At least in the German system, PrEP will never be paid by insurance system. So couldn't there be any plans that for this indication, Truvada should be cheaper if people have to pay for it by themselves? Thank you.
Great. Yes.
Okay, Marie Leicher from Belgium. It has been said that PrEP should be part of a comprehensive prevention strategy. We are 30 years into the epidemic. We all know the word combination prevention. I'm just asking, out of this, all these demonstration projects that are now ongoing, how many are serious about that concept? In other words, the behavioral components in it, or are they just mainly geared towards the increase uptake of PrEP, or is this really serious thinking about evaluating truly combination prevention programs where PrEP is one of the tools within the bigger package? So it's an open question and an urge at the same time.
Open, but a great question, Maria. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Daryl Sand from Toronto in Canada. Just a question to the whole panel about where it sees the whole research agenda on identifying good PrEP candidates or people eligibility for PrEP going forward, especially in light of two points. One is that, you know, despite the wealth of demo projects that are about to be reported on or in the future, you know, they in and of themselves by necessity have their own inclusion criteria as part of the design. So they're not likely to answer this question about how do we identify the highest risk people in whom we're likely to accrue the greatest benefits. And the second point being, you know, one of the very intuitively obvious and reasonable eligibility criteria that's been proposed in some of the trials and some of the demo projects so far is, for example, an MSM population that I work with is having an STI, which makes a lot of sense, except that we know that a lot of the STIs, chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, that yes, they increase the risk of HIV, but a lot of them are being acquired because of, you know, guys participating in just unprotected oral sex, which arguably is not the best target population in whom to target PrEP in the future.
Great, thanks so much.
Right. Yes, my question is to James. So because evidence from initial studies on PrEP was showing that it was more successful on MSM, and then FDA approval came, and then you are saying that now outside demonstration projects is 1.8 more likely to be prescribed to women. And then also initial studies were showing that PrEP will have more benefits to population with higher risk practices like commercial sex workers. And then after FDA approval, it's prescribed to women who are not commercial sex workers. So do you know why this is happening outside demonstration projects? Because the evidence was showing one way and now reality is showing another way. And to the whole panel, something that was not asked on the previous session, but probably you do have the answer, is about the stigma associated with PrEP use, because I really don't understand that part, because in many countries, stigma associated with condom use is a lot bigger, and I think you cannot hide a condom, but you can never require to say that you are on PrEP. You can be arrested with a condom, but I don't think you can be arrested with Truvada on your blood.
All right, we'll get to stigma as well. So a really great set of questions. Some of them are very data specific, sometimes data misunderstood or misinterpreted, but we'll try to get to all of it as best we can. Let me maybe start with you, Lute, as both, you know, your previous life as a researcher around PrEP, topical and oral, more recently at the Gates Foundation, where you've actually, the foundation has funded the two pivotal trials at the FDA, and I think very clearly the data is strong for men who have sex with men. It's even stronger for men and women from the Partners PrEP study. But I wonder if you can describe, in response to some of this, particularly to Maria's question about, are we really just studying pills in demonstration projects, or is there an attempt to understand the combinations for the future?
Yes, as Maria and I were discussing during the break, there is a tendency in some of the projects, it depends on which projects we talk about, do focus on literally how do we implement PrEP, how can we provide PrEP to populations at risk. Some see it in a bigger context, and I personally, so here is a disclaimer, I don't speak on behalf of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, I personally think it's very important that we take it in a broader context and that we try to see in real life, can we make PrEP part of a whole prevention package for HIV among populations at risk. I think we all agree it should be a targeted population. And at the same time, also, as has been said by others, including by, I think, Daryl on the panel, work with providers who come outside what we think of as HIV treatment people, because that's not where HIV uninfected people will go in many settings to get in touch with a service regarding prevention. So that can be, I don't know, VCTs or sexual health centers, but I think it's very important, as Jim Jared pointed out, the awareness by everybody who can provide. It is not, we also have to go away from not only if you take antiretrovirals, you're dying, but also it's such a complicated pill to prescribe. Down the line, Trevada is very easy to prescribe and to use. So that we work with providers and that we make also indeed the communities who are at risk of HIV aware of the package, and that in the communities it becomes known there is something that is part of a package that could help you if you cannot use condoms and other prevention methods. And I think that's very important that we work on the whole issue.
That's terrific, and I think it begins to address some of Anna's question, which I know we'll come back to for many months and years to come about providers. Suat, some of the questions about how to identify and engage with some of the potential users at greatest risk. Thailand's hosted actually PrEP trials both with people who inject drugs in the CDC study, as well as was a site of the IPREC study. As you think about it in Thailand and knowing both further research around rectal microbicides, identifying the trial participant is one thing, but identifying the potential PrEP user, and I'm wondering how you're thinking about that in Chiang Mai and perhaps in potential follow-up to research there.
Thank you. Let me share the experience that I have from the IPREC and IPREC OLE. Normally, to starting the new drug, a new tool to implement from the proof of concept to the implementation is quite challenging because the people always scared to starting the new thing. Let's say we have involved in the IPREC OLE in the second phase, and we have allowed 60 MSM participants in the IPREC OLE, and then we ask them do they want to on PrEP or off PrEP. Allow 50 people or 70%, they say they want to on PrEP, and most of the reason is because they said they have engaged in some high risk behavior, and then they have some problem to use other HIV prevention packet as well. Another 10 or let's say allow 20% say they want to off PrEP, and most of the people who select to off PrEP because they don't have they may not have the sexual partner during that time, or they think they have very low risk, and then they don't have the problem to use a condom. We followed them for 18 months, and we just stopped a few months ago. Among these people who are on PrEP, no zero convert happened in the last 18 months. Among the people who are off PrEP as well, but with the comprehensive prevention package, also no zero conversion happened. So this is an experience that we learned from the IPREC OLE. During we waiting from the IPREC, the first try, and then we waiting to start the IPREC OLE. Allow 1 year that we're waiting, we have allowed 5 or 6 zero convert happen. during only that waiting time from around 100, but it's banned from the IPEC. For the IPEC OLE, as I say, we don't have any zero convert happen, but at the end when we stop the visit for one participant, and he is a person who are on prep, and he become to be the zero convert. Later, 1 month after we stop, and then we found that he has some symptom, STI symptom, then some symptom like acute infection, and then we found he has HIV positive at the last visit, but HIV testing is negative. And then we go to see the drug level in this participant who are on prep. They have no drug. At least in the last 3 months before he has a drug in his drug before, but we cannot detect the drug at the last 3 months before he stopped the visit. So what we learned from here for the Thailand setting, I think for the general population, the prevalence is quite lower than 1%. But among MSM population in Thailand, the prevalence vary between 10, 20, or 25% in some big province. In Chiang Mai, it's around 15 to 20% among young MSM. So we did a survey in Chiang Mai last year among the MSM population in Chiang Mai using the venom-based sampling technique. Awareness about the PrEP is around 66%. And among this MSM population that we do the survey, around 40% say they very likely that they want to use a PrEP. Even efficacy at 50%. So it is the time now how to move from the clinical trial, and then how to do some bigger demonstration project in the country. And the government have organized a workshop just May in this year, many months ago, and then they invited MOPH people, the Department of Disease Control, the researcher from our side, and then some people from the academic and also some civil society as well, and talking about how to move the PrEP from the trial to the implementation, and then we are thinking we may plan to move forward to do some demonstration project in the primary health service setting or maybe specialty health setting, but we may take some time, and then hopefully we can do some demonstration project in allow few provinces and really do it in the health service setting.
Great. So thank you so much. I think one of the things that Anna mentioned about planning providers and just having the broader framework, I think, is something that's consistent. We have a couple of questions that perhaps are somewhat unanswerable, like who do we hold accountable in the UK? I certainly can't answer that. But what I'm going to do is I know we're kind of winding down time-wise, but what I'd like to do is go down the panel and certainly, Jim, there were some questions about the US statistics and particularly about why Gilead isn't marketing. Sheena, maybe you could address the UK piece a bit. But I'm wondering if each of you, as we go down the line, looking back now 15 months, 14 months post-FDA approval, there are people who say in the U.S. and internationally we failed. And there are many others who've said, and I would put myself in this category, we haven't even begun to try to see if we will fail. And I'm wondering if each of you could, in your final 30 seconds or so, what would success look like in September 2014? Whether it's a quantitative metric, whether it's some change in policy, what should be different in September 2014 if any of you were to be invited back here? So maybe we'll just start with you, Jared, and go down the line.
I already talked a lot. Success in 2014, access to PrEP.
Great. Jim, you get a little extra couple seconds if you want to address these U.S.-specific questions as well.
So one question was why Gilead doesn't promote PrEP. It's a bit of a delicate issue. We are obviously a for-profit company, and PrEP is perhaps more controversial than HIV treatment. And I think in some ways the company could actually get in the way of making an important public health intervention more broadly available if it was viewed primarily as an effort by the company to make additional dollars out of an existing product. So we're very careful about providing support for educational activities, supporting third-party groups that want to engage in community outreach and in education, but we actually do not have our sales representatives actively promoting PrEP at this point in time. That could change over time. We certainly are legally allowed to do that, and if there's enough support from the community that it would be helpful for us to do that, I think we certainly are willing to reevaluate that position at any point in time. other questions I would need?
Success for you.
Success. It's a gradual. We've talked about innovation and how it diffuses into the community, and I think I'd like to see broader awareness of PrEP amongst community providers a year from maybe if we could. I don't know where it depends on the geography. We could get a 50 to 100% increase in awareness next year if we could have double the number of people who are on PrEP in the U.S. And I'd like to see actually broader registrations and I'd like to see more interest in having PrEP available in other geographies outside of the U.S.
Great.
Daryl.
The price
is, at this point in time, it's the same for treatment as it is for prevention. It might be possible to envision special scenarios where you have clinics, for example, that I think it would be great to have centers of excellence, and I think I'm not an expert on each country's healthcare delivery system, and the U.S. has its own peculiarities, as you well know. But I think it would be possible, certainly, to set up centers of excellence and possibly even to deliver PrEP in those centers of excellence where you have high concentration of high-risk individuals and healthcare providers that are well-trained to intervene there, particularly since it's an MSM epidemic that's driving the epidemic in many geographies, particularly in the developed world and developing world as well. But I think selecting some areas, developing centers of excellence, and perhaps even distributing through the government or whatever, a PrEP might provide some means for providing it more broadly. Access won't be as much of a limiting issue.
Great. Daryl.
Well, one year. I would like to see greater access, but a broad spectrum access outside of just the audiences here, outside the biomedical audiences. For the communities that I work with, I think it would absolutely require engagement across a spectrum of social service and other types of organizations and agencies to be able to engage in this discussion. So I would say there'd have to be greater awareness towards greater benefit articulation for at-risk communities, and in that, to see that discussion more broadly occurring would be a benefit.
That's great. Lute?
I will be very brief. I agree with what said before, access and availability of broad HIV prevention programs, not just only PrEP, and that a little bit of the discussion that we sometimes hear, do we use antiretrovirus for treatment or do we use it for prevention, that discussion is way beyond us, but that it's end-end.
Great. Sheena?
So maybe I could answer Marie's question in part, because I think, you know, behavior change takes time. And one of the things that PrEP or doing a study around PrEP gives you is time. You do engage with people over more than one occasion, and it gives you an opportunity to implement those other things. So that's important. But Mitchell, you asked me to talk about Gaz answered it, Roger. The money is the bottom line, and so it's not enough to have biological efficacy. Your first question was will, wasn't it? Will it ever be available? It'll have to be evidence of cost effectiveness, I believe, at the moment. But short of that, and whether we can get to that through demonstrating adherence and the ability to target the right populations who will take it and need it, then I think that defining the next research question, bringing all those stakeholders together who are all responsible, Roger. They're all responsible. The funders, the, you know, the advocacy groups and the clinicians, the healthcare providers, the lot. We have to bring them together to define the next research agenda, because right now I would only see PrEP being available in the UK on a large scale through a large-scale research study. It's hard for me to see in 2014 we'll have it available any other way.
Great. Helen?
For South Africa, I think it's fair to say at the moment the policymakers are overwhelmed with what we're trying to do with treatment. And when I raised this question in preparation for this panel, one of the policymakers said to me, can we just do fixed-dose combinations first, please, and don't speak about anything else? So I think in a year's time, if there is registration of the product, I think that might change the dialogue. So what I would be interested in seeing in the next year would be whether that dialogue creates a popular demand. Because remember, with treatment, we're talking about a minority of people who need treatment in a population. With us, the majority of people would be needing if they wanted it, would be needing PrEP. It's a much larger number of people. What we're talking about is a massive service implication. So I think I would be very interested to see three things in a year's time. Whether there will be a dialogue that creates demand amongst civil society and amongst some of the populations, so we start to see people saying we want this and how we would like it. Secondly, whether that equally creates a different dialogue with policymakers who are sweating at the moment. It's very challenging for them, whether that opens up a different policy. And thirdly, I think from the research and implementation side, to really look at some pilot demonstration sites that, as was said, should be an integrated package, but which really look at things that have the potential to be feasible, that take into account stigma of use and also take into account healthcare worker attitudes and how you bring them with you on the way.
Great. Suat.
For Thailand, because they have the biomedical HIV prevention subcommittee under the National AIDS Committee, and I sit in that committee as well. So what we think for next year that Thailand will move forward. I think we will try to scale up the HIV testing in the country, especially the key affected population include MSM and IDU, because the way uptake HIV testing is quite low, and then the people access to the drug, the CD4, the median CD4 is also quite low as in many countries. So by scale up HIV testing and then target some population, we can pick up some HIV positive and then we can link them to care. For the HIV negative who engage in the high-risk waiver, then we are going to provide a comprehensive HIV prevention package, and then PrEP will be one thing that we are thinking to do the demonstration project in 2 or 3 provinces in the country next year.
Great. Thank you. I mean, I thank the organizers for the indulgence of a few extra minutes. I want to thank the whole panel and just end by saying that truly success will be, in someone answering to Roger's question at the very beginning, that we get more field, more diversity of the field perspectives of true field delivery a year from now, and that the conversation changes so that every time we have a PrEP conversation, we don't list every issue as a barrier, but rather with solutions on how to begin to overcome them. So thank you very much, and I'll turn it back to Jane.